He was here, in a home, with me and my mother. Before he was gone, he loved me. My grandmother looked around her room like someone might be listening before sitting down on the bed beside me. I was still staring into the man's face thinking, oh yeah, my daddy. Adults had told me about him before, I was sure, but I hadn't turned those talks into memories. It must not have seemed like useful information at the time. My grandmother leaned toward me and said, do you know how much he loved you? She sat back on her arms and looked toward the open door. When she began to speak, the first words came out in a sigh, like she had been holding them in for a long time and was so relieved to finally let them fall away. Your daddy took you everywhere. He would have taken you to work if he could have. She laughed a little to herself and bumped her shoulder into mine like we were old friends. Your mama would get so mad at him for taking you all over the place, making everybody meet you, and you'd be wearing one sock and have lines of sour milk stuck between the rolls of that fat neck. Now she was reeling, cracking herself up. She made her voice thin and whiny, not at all like my mother's when she quoted her. She'd say, don't be taking my baby out here looking any kind of way. We both laughed at this, both picturing my mother in one of her rages, angry at my father and protective of how the world saw me. I liked to think of my mother as protective, like she could rage the devil away if he came for me in the night. He wanted to show you off any chance he got, and your mama just wanted you to look good while he was doing it. They wanted you so bad and loved you so much. They were just young. She said that last part like an apology, and I didn't understand why. When your daddy got locked up, I was in Missouri, and I hadn't even heard. Her mouth shut, eyes closed, and she sat there, silent, remembering or forgetting or trying to say the right thing. When I got back from Missouri, your mama was waiting on the steps of my house. She was crying and pregnant with your brother and rolling around, pulling at my skirt, going, I miss him. Mama, I miss him. Grandma wailed a bit as she said this, using every muscle in her face to impress upon me how racked with pain my mother must have been, how much it must have hurt to see her own daughter in that much agony. She looked at her hands. I didn't know what was going on. But I told her to get up and come in the house. She was so sad your daddy had to go, and I didn't even know what to say. He had to go. But that doesn't mean he didn't love all of y'all. I know he did. A swell of gratitude for my grandmother, her photos, and her stories filled my chest. My father loved me, and my mother protected me. But in seconds, this memory soured. I thought of what Grandma told me once about God. She said, you don't just ask for things when you pray. You pray to say thank you to God, and you pray so he knows you're thinking about the right things. The thought had rocked me. I hadn't known I was supposed to be thinking about specific things that God wanted me to think about. Panicked, I'd ask my grandmother to tell me what each of these right thoughts were so I could be sure to think them. She'd responded as if I weren't a silly child asking a silly question, but someone she was sharing top secret information with. Just be good and you won't have to worry about it. Then she turned and begun to chat with another church grandmother, the kind of conversation I knew it would be disrespectful to interrupt, while my head continued to spin. I hadn't understood why she wouldn't just tell me what God wanted me to do. Now I wondered if God would be mad I'd forgotten somebody who loved me. Instead of asking her any more questions, back in her bedroom, surrounded by the images of people who had been important enough to warrant record of at one time or another, I told my grandmother something. I'm going to pray for my daddy. It seemed a good way not to forget him, by adding his name to my earnest nightly prayers. Girl, she said, rising from the bed and gathering the last few unfolded garments in her hand, God has really touched you. She turned back toward the closet, checked her watch, and told me her friend Wendy was coming to pick her up at any moment. She kissed my forehead and said she needed to start getting ready. Go play with your brother. He's probably looking for you. I rushed down the stairs of her apartment, through the kitchen, and out onto the shared back porch. I shut her door behind me, but instead of doing as I'd just been instructed, I hopped down the few steps leading to our backyard, laid on my back in the grass, closed my eyes, and tried to turn my father into a memory. With the sunlight dancing on my eyelids, I pictured my father carrying me from person to person in a crowd, eyes wide, teeth white and beaming, asking each one if they'd had the pleasure of meeting his baby. I pictured my mother admonishing him good-naturedly about the state of my clothes, but glowing with pride because I belonged to her and I was still a miracle. The photo I'd found of the four of us would be seared into my memory forever, our bodies all wrapped around one another's, leaning forward as if we might break into a poorly choreographed tango or waltz at any moment. In the picture, we are frozen this way together, happy, sad, and afraid all at the same time. In the grass, where I made the memory I wanted to keep, we all dance out of the prison doors together, one family with joy in our smiles and eyes. When we step outside, it is into deep and freshly fallen snow. Chapter 5. My mother met a man visiting from Florida, a cousin of someone she knew, and they hit it off. We visited him sometimes. My brother usually stayed behind with one of our aunts or with grandma. At 4 years old, I was more manageable. My brother was young enough to be temperamental and far too clingy. There's a photo of him we passed around as children that I haven't seen in years. In the picture, he sits in the middle of the hallway in our apartment, his small round body leaned all the way to one side, the top of his head nearly touching the ground, keening for comfort or relief as he cries right into the camera. He wouldn't let me go anywhere. My mother would pass the photo around, looking frustrated but also slightly proud. My brother reached for her in a way I did not, and it seemed I was rewarded with more places to go. I knew how to disappear. Sometimes my mother needed me to disappear. She needed her life back after my father's arrest, and this new person seemed like a good way to get it. He was nice enough, though his background with women was messy, according to my grandmother. He was always assuring my mother that he was done with someone they only ever seemed to refer to as her. Sometimes they would fight about her. Once, they fought so bad, he swung a bag of frozen bread at my mother, missed, and caught me in the face. There was a sudden burst of confusing pain. Then blood shot out of my nose like it was running away from me. It landed on my shirt and remained there while we all stared. My mother dragged me into the bathroom, sat me on the toilet, and began sticking wads of tissue up my nose. I didn't cry. I was scared that my bloody nose was about to break something between them, and I didn't want my mother to be alone or angry. Plus, I liked him. He was kind to me and always kept king-size candy bars in the bottom of his refrigerator. I insisted I was fine, and it didn't hurt. My mother was already crying and yelling in the direction of her boyfriend. Look! Look what you did to my baby! She continued jamming toilet paper up my nose, and it was starting to hurt. My mother, who only cried like the tears were being ripped from her face, blubbered while she yelled at her boyfriend. Something was happening between her and this man. Maybe something to do with her? I didn't know. But I didn't want my mother to cry anymore. I hated it when she cried or yelled. I hated it when she was unhappy. I let her stick tissues into my nose as long as she wanted, and I didn't complain. Her tears told me she was afraid, and I did not want her to be afraid for me. Standing just outside the bathroom door, her boyfriend buried his face in his palms, then thrust them back into his pockets. He looked sad when he looked at my mother, and even sadder when he looked at me. He crouched down in front of me, took my hand in his, and met my eyes with his own. "I'm sorry," he said. "I'm so sorry." "It's okay. I'm okay." He was looking right at me, but it didn't feel like he was speaking to me. I didn't know any adults who apologized to children, and so his apology felt as wrong to me as my mother's tears. I didn't want anyone to have to be sorry to me. I didn't want to make anyone cry. I wanted to make it all stop. "It's okay," I said. "I forgive you." It was the first time I remember saying that to someone. He would come first in the long line of men who would seek to make amends with me. He came before I realized I had the choice not to forgive, especially when the person offering the apology didn't seem sorry. It still felt good to be apologized to, no matter who it was meant for. Up until that point, no one had ever apologized for hitting me. I liked the way it made me feel, like I was worth feeling sorry over after someone hurt me, even if they didn't mean it, like it mattered that I hurt. My mother never apologized. Back in one of those memories I'm not supposed to have, I remember being in the kitchen while my mother prepared to relax my hair. I was standing on a stool or chair as I was not yet tall enough for my head to reach the sink where my hair was being washed. I had been coerced into agreeing to this by smiling adults who'd asked me, "Don't you want pretty hair?" in higher voices than usual. I didn't know what having pretty hair meant, but I liked how their faces lit up when they asked. Now, my mother hovered over me, the large, beautiful hands I would inherit wrapped around my skull, her long and heavy fingers working the relaxer away from my scalp and into the water stream. I hadn't known the relaxer would hurt. Maybe someone warned me. But by the time it felt like someone had snuck up and set the top of my head on fire, I had forgotten the warning. While fire ants marched across my scalp, my mother tried to push my head under the stainless steel faucet. My small body hardened with hesitation. As my head went deeper into the sink, the sound of the water hitting the bottom and splashing onto the sides echoed until it sounded more like the big crashing beach waves I'd only ever seen on TV. The combination of my burning scalp, the pressure from my mother's hands, and the crushing walls of sound coming from the sink caused me to simply freeze. I stood there, burning, dripping, locked up, and refusing to turn my head in either direction my mother requested. She got angry. My mother grabbed the back of my head with her mighty hand and turned my face into the running water. The water ran into my eyes and up my nose, and at least a bit of it soothed the edges of my hairline. The watery echo became deafening until it filled my ears, and that's when everything went bad. If I opened my eyes, my mother's face became a blur of a portrait that wouldn't stop melting. I could just barely identify the familiar colors of her skin, hair, and clothing. I considered this may not be my mother at all. When I looked away toward the sink, when I closed my eyes, perhaps there had been a switch. I had no idea who was holding me now. I couldn't see, taste, smell, or hear anything. The water that had gone up my nose was threatening to fall down my throat and become trapped there. Everything I felt hurt. I couldn't breathe. I opened my mouth to shout, and the stream poured into an airway. I choked and spit and finally cleared an airway enough to yell, "Mama!" I lifted myself from the sink and stared at my mother accusingly. It had been her the whole time. She did not comfort me or apologize. She stared back and said, "Stop being dramatic." I didn't know what that meant either, but I knew I didn't want to be in trouble. More than that, I still wanted pretty hair. Slowly, I bent my head back toward the sink, and she began again to finger comb the relaxer from my hair. This time, a bit more gently, and I couldn't deny that it felt good to feel it all wash away. But I stayed tense. After my hair was rinsed, conditioned, rinsed, shampooed again, rinsed again, blow-dried, greased, and pressed, it was shiny. Dark like my mother's, reaching almost to my shoulders, I looked at myself in the mirror and I liked what I saw. My hair was pretty. Still, my eyes stung and water lingered in the canals of my ears. My body was still stiff and I was already exhausted from the unrelenting tension. My mother, smiling at me in the mirror, carefully watched my reaction, eager for my approval. Just moments before, she turned into an angry stranger with my vulnerable, defiant body in her hands. For that, this is not pretty enough. I never forgot my mother's face through that curtain of water, warped by the stream, yet clear in its unapologetic expression of rage. It was not a memory I tried to keep. Chapter 6. In those days, my mother's moods were more playful more often. She still got mad at my brother and me a lot, but she also played with us, and we loved it when she did. Our favorite game was something she'd made up called "I'm Not Your Mother." During the game, she would turn off all the lights in the apartment and growl, "I'm not your mother!" My brother and I would scream and flail and run around the room trying to find a place to hide. Our mother would chase after us, snarling and swiping at us with her long arms, just missing on purpose until she finally decided to catch one of us. She'd scoop one of us up and pretend to eat our limbs and faces. It mostly consisted of tickling until we could barely breathe. The game was fun until the day I took my mother seriously. When she grabbed my brother and started to eat him, he screamed out, "Hashi, help me!" For a second, it didn't sound like he was having fun. For a second, I thought I saw the mother in Mama's face. Something about the tone of his scream was too sharp. She'd lost control. As soon as it entered my head, I ran into the kitchen and grabbed a knife. I sprinted back into the room, held the knife above my head, above my mother, with RC still wriggling beneath her. "Get off my brother!" My mother, seeing the glint of the knife in the darkness, immediately released my brother, ran for the nearest light switch, and illuminated the room. When she saw me standing there, 4 years old, and more than ready to mortally wound her for daring to touch the person I loved most in the world, she laughed. My mother laughed so hard she couldn't stop laughing. Her uncontrollable laughter made my brother and me laugh, so we laughed with her. The three of us fell to the floor, clutched our stomachs, and rolled around with laughter. My mother laughed until she wet herself, and then she laughed harder. That was the last time we played that game, but there were others. Every once in a while, my mother, brother, and I would dash around the apartment, checking every couch cushion, corner, and cranny for loose change. My mother had already been keeping a jar of some kind full of pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters she'd found loose in the bottom of her purse. Though we dipped into that pool of coins every once in a while for a run to Brownlee's Market, where my brother and I would be able to pick out pieces of penny candy from what I assumed were glass jars belonging to Mr. Brownlee himself, the container would still grow heavier and heavier over time. When my mother told us we were collecting change, that meant we were going to the bank to send our little metal friends down a big spiraling tube that spit out green paper money. Sometimes my mother would hand me and my brother our own dollar to keep. Even if she didn't, I didn't complain. For me, it was enough to have all gone on this little adventure with one another and to have watched the magic machine swallow our change and offer us something new in return. I wanted to be one of those magic machines that spit out real dollar bills, and one day I told my brother that we should take the pennies from my mother's stash and eat them. Before we began swallowing copper discs one by one, I hadn't really wondered how many we could ingest. Then, once I started, I couldn't stop wondering. I swallowed one after another, and my brother kept pace beside me, my truest and most loyal friend, always game to go wherever I led. We ate until we couldn't eat anymore, and then with the fresh and sturdy constitutions of healthy babes, we found another game to play. About 1.5 days later, my brother and I spent so much time alternating going in and out of the bathroom, my mother got suspicious. We were both potty trained for some time now, but not great flushers, so it wasn't long before we heard a screech coming from the bathroom seconds after one of us had left. My brother and I jumped up and ran to the open door where my mother stood looking down into the toilet in horror. We looked in too, worried one of us had left something in there that wasn't supposed to be flushed, like car keys or the head of a doll. But there was just poop. Then I saw what I'd missed in the first scan. It was poop, that couldn't be denied, but it was shiny. The soft ripple of water in the still running toilet caused the copper edges of digested coins to glimmer in the bending light. Are you motherfuckers crazy? Our mother didn't blink, but her voice was so calm we knew it best to stay quiet as well. You could have broken my toilet! She slammed the seat down, and the resounding clap made us jump. We waited for the blows, for the mother to come claim the pound of flesh that was rightfully hers. But instead, she began to laugh. She laughed and laughed and began to ask an imaginary someone out loud, "Whose kids are these?" My brother and I started laughing too, but before we could have too much fun, my mother fell silent again. If you do this again, it's going to be real trouble. Do you understand me? We said we did and backed away from the door as she walked toward us. She made her way back to the couch, shaking her head and giggling. I was always trying to figure out which version of myself to be to not upset her. I didn't often get it right. I didn't realize I wasn't supposed to know or repeat the things my mother and grandmother gossiped about until about a year later when a woman had come knocking at the door. She'd previously occupied my aunt and uncle's apartment above us, and my mother and grandmother would whisper about the roaches creeping out of her apartment and into ours. My grandmother insisting at least once that she'd watched one of the bugs make the whole trip from one apartment to the other. When they saw the neighbor, they'd offer one another a look and sometimes added a single word as an explanation for it. Drugs. The knock came again, and my mother told me to go peek through the window and see who it was. I did as she asked, then proceeded to turn and loudly announce to the rest of the room, "It's just the crackhead lady from upstairs." My mother's anger came swift and sharp across my butt and back. I had no idea what I'd done wrong. The pain rattled in my small body and mind. I was confused. I didn't know how to be the child my mother wanted me to be. Just as quick as her blows came, she erupted in laughter. She would later recount this story to other family members, nearly choking herself as she giggled through it. I couldn't believe she said that. I sure did whoop her ass that day. My mother's face would split into the smile I rarely saw. It illuminated her entire face from hairline to chin. I thought that smile was her prettiest. I didn't mind when she told those stories. I craved seeing her happy, witnessing that smile. It was easier to laugh at the jokes after you'd forgotten the pain. That smile sometimes made me forget the pain, and I would laugh too. Over time, forgetting the pain to make the best joke got easier and easier and easier. Chapter 7. My mother wanted to be with her boyfriend. He wanted to be with her too. But there was distance and youth, and there always seemed to be some other woman involved. It would not last between them. He'd come into her life quickly, and he left the same way. The culmination of the first phase of that relationship, the baby, my second brother, was born without ever breathing. My grandmother said he was born small and gray, with an exposed serpentine spine. When she repeated this story, she would push up her glasses, wrinkle her nose, and use her index finger to make a wavy line in the air to illustrate the curve of his body. She said my mother held him for hours, kissed the top of his head, rocked him against her chest. My mother hadn't wanted to have another baby, not without being married, but abortion wasn't an option, and he kept growing inside her. My mother could not fathom what kind of good Christian woman would end the life of a child, even if she was in no position to provide for him, and my mother very much wanted to be a good Christian woman. Still, she did not want to be pregnant, and when the baby was born, already dead, she blamed her desire to be free for his passing. She named him after his father. She did not mark his grave. My mother came home to us raw and all alone. My grandmother told me she sat in the bathtub for hours, bleeding into the water. She stared into the space between herself and the walls, her body purging its sin, staining the off-white fiberglass. Her silence worried my brother and me for reasons we couldn't grasp just yet. He and I would sit close enough to hear the water make small splashes when she adjusted herself, making sure she wasn't giving up on breathing or living, that she wasn't giving up on us. On the other side of the door, my mother sent noiseless prayers into her bath water, repenting in spontaneous expulsions, oblivious to the world growing red around her. Grandma and my mother's sisters wanted her to be well. They took her back to see the man who had delivered baby Daryl and the hole in his back. They told him my mother's symptoms because she'd lost her voice somewhere down in her chest, somewhere they couldn't reach in and grab it. She'd stopped trying to find her voice days before. She was content in her silence, in her bleeding, and in her inevitable demise. The doctor told my grandmother it was psychosomatic. My grandmother called him a quack and a demon. He said, "There's no reason for her to be bleeding anymore. She's using her mind to punish herself. She won't get better until she chooses to get better." Someone decided my brother would stay with my mother and I would leave with my grandmother. We moved to her father's, my great-grandfather's farmhouse in Columbia, Missouri. A few years later, when I couldn't quite remember the worst of this time, I'd ask why I was sent off with Grandma Billy before kindergarten. I would be told, "Because you said you wanted to go." I disappeared into a new life in Missouri, a life without either brother, living or dead, and a grandmother who put strawberries and whipped cream on my waffles without blood under her nails. There was no one for me to protect or worry over. I missed my mother, but less and less every day. To keep me company, I had a dog, a goat, and a great-grandfather who threw hammers at wild pigs in the backyard, then paid me $2 to collect the tools and bring them back in the house. It was a game I thought my brother might enjoy, but I tried not to think of my brother too much. When I did, I felt sick with missing him. I couldn't forget him if I tried. My grandmother and I had our own routine. I had school and daycare all week, and I got to see a movie and get one toy on Saturdays. We alternated picking the movies, and when it was my turn, I could pick whichever movie I wanted, all by myself. I was electrified by the power of my choice and made my decisions based almost exclusively on the posters outside the theater. That's how I ended up picking films like Lorenzo's Oil, Passion Fish, and Groundhog Day. I was easy to please and never protested my grandmother's picks, even after Fire in the Sky made me cry myself to sleep for a week. My grandmother was loving, but being comforting wasn't her gift. Each night she taught me to read, alternating between the Holy Bible, Barbie comics, and supermarket celebrity tabloids. I thought Princess Diana and Mary Magdalene would have looked similar. I thought the same about Billy Ray Cyrus and Jesus. When the thought of alien abduction kept me up, the Star magazine I kept under my pillow reminded me to stop holding my breath. Living with my grandmother and her father in the fields of Missouri, I learned to think only of myself for hours at a time. Spending half a day alone, free of the company of people who would distract me from my being, I learned to think about who I was becoming, and what I wanted. I spent my free time exploring my great-grandfather's land, roaming farther than I was allowed. Too young and dumb to be scared of them, I made a game of sneaking up on and catching garden snakes by the tail. I caught them fast enough to shock them, and then dropped them before they caught my skin between their fangs. I was only bitten once. It was fast and painful, but I did not scream. My eyes got wide and my arms flailed around until it let go. After the garden snake released me, I closed my eyes and leaned against a tree. I steadied my breath and soothed myself by speaking directly into the two puncture wounds in my first finger. "It don't hurt, Ashley." I cradled the stinging hand with its opposite. "If it hurt, you'd die. You won't die." On our Christmas visit to Indiana, my mother accused my grandmother of turning me against her. "She acts like she doesn't even know who I am." My mother's tongue was coated in venom, her familiar anger rising in the back of her throat. A few days before Christmas, my mother came into the living room and saw me playing with a doll. It was the same doll she'd bought and wrapped for me under the tree. It was a doll she knew I'd love. Something she hoped would remind me of the games we used to play and the life we'd had together back when we lived in the studio apartment. Now she was renting a two-bedroom house with enough room for me to return, but I was still in Missouri. No one thought it would be a good idea for me to move back to Fort Wayne in the middle of a school year, but my mother missed me, and she wanted me home. She screamed at me for opening the present, a gift she had to have worked overtime to purchase. I did not only feel distant from my mother, I felt angry with her and unsure of what she wanted with me. She sent me away, called me back, and now she seemed mad that I was here. I started to walk away from her and found myself buried face first in her living room carpet. My mother kicked me. I didn't cry. After a few moments, my mother picked me up and held me against her. Being held was rare and precious, an offering in and of itself. I rejected it, making my body go limp. I hoped she thought I was dead or paralyzed. I wanted her to think she'd really hurt me. I wanted her to apologize like her old boyfriend did. My grandmother walked into the room, took a look at us, and asked what happened. My mother told her I'd opened my gift. My grandmother explained that she'd bought me the same doll in Missouri. My grandmother knelt beside me. "Are you okay, baby?" I looked toward the front door. "I'm fine. It don't hurt. I'm not dead." My mother walked into her bedroom and shut the door. "Grandma, tell her it's okay. I'm not dead. I'm alive." When my grandmother and I returned to the farmhouse, I jumped out of my grandfather's car and ran into the house. I ran into the sitting room where my tea set was always on the back table, then into the bathroom where my good toothbrush was still in the pink cup behind the sink. I touched all of the things that reminded me of my new life in Missouri where no one hit me. I could read as much as I wanted, and there were no rusty red stains left in rings around the bathtub. I spoke to my grandmother without looking at her. "Don't ever make me leave again, okay? I don't want to leave again." She looked down at me, then into the backyard, into the places I played without permission. She grabbed my hand and walked me out toward the trees, grabbing a shovel and a burlap bag next to the grill on the way. We walked farther and farther back until we were in the part of our land where my great-grandfather let the grasses grow long. My grandmother stomped around a bit, then staked the shovel's blade into the dirt. She dug slowly and with purpose, like she was sneaking up on the earth spread out before us. The ground was soft, so it wasn't long before she told me to come closer. I leaned over the hole and saw a garden snake. No, 2, 3, 4, a lot of garden snakes. They were in some sort of a knot, though not stuck together. They moved quickly and deliberately over and around one another. They were not fighting, and they did not seem to be trying to get away from us or anything else. "What are they doing, Grandma?" My grandmother stared into the hole. "They're loving each other, baby." She reached into the bag, poured lighter fluid into the hole, then a lit match. The grass in and around the hole burned, and then so did the snakes. My first instinct was to reach in and throw them as far as I could, to safety, but I hesitated when I remembered their bite. I waited too long to do them any good. The snakes did not slither away or thrash around as they burned. They held each other tighter. Even as the scales melted from their bodies, their inclination was to squeeze closer to the other snakes wrapped around them. Their green lengths blackened and bubbled, causing the flesh that simmered underneath each individual metallic hood to ooze. They did not panic. They did not run. I started to cry. "You will have to go back. We'll both go back home. Your mama misses you." My grandmother reached over and grabbed my hand, both of us still staring into the hole. "These things catch fire without letting each other go. We don't give up on our people. We don't stop loving them." She looked into my face, her eyes watering at the bottoms. "Not even when we're burning alive." Chapter 8. When we took the Greyhound bus back to Indiana, my grandmother dressed us in matching hot pink sweatsuits so we wouldn't lose one another in a crowd. When all the people waiting for the buses got pushed together, especially while boarding or leaving, my grandmother squeezed my fingers in the palm of her hand, holding me close to the side of her body, staring daggers at anyone she felt got too close to me. I hated the hand-holding. I could feel the fear and tension in my grandmother's face travel down her neck and shoulders, into her arm, then into her hand, crushing mine. It made me feel afraid, but there didn't seem to be anything to be afraid of. It made me afraid of whatever I couldn't see coming. But I love the matching outfits. I was too young to be embarrassed by them, had no need to feel separate from her and our looks, and besides, my grandmother always knew how to dress. I was proud to look like her. proud to be seen by her, and felt slightly safer knowing she was always watching. Weeks earlier, she told me it was time to go back home, that my mother missed me, but I did not agree. I rested my forehead against the bus window, careful to avoid the red bar warning that this was an emergency exit. One time, on a bus ride before this one, my grandmother told me that if I fell asleep against the bar, I might slip out of the window and into the road before anyone would notice I was gone. As she said it, I could see it. My small sleeping body tumbling from the side of the bus, falling into the traffic, smashed into the road, and all the bus patrons, driver included, continuing toward the Hoosier State with no real sense that a little girl who had just been real and alive beside them was now dead and gone behind them. I taught myself to sleep lightly, to feel the difference between the window and the bar on my face. As I tried to sleep now, the light vibration of driving down the highway soothing me, I dreamed of the tea set I'd left behind and the farm where I could be anything and anywhere I wanted with a little imagination. When I woke again, my grandmother was telling me that my mother had moved into a new place and there would be more room to play, that we would all be starting over again in Indiana. I did start over in Indiana, but not in the way my grandmother promised. Things were different when I got back. It had been almost a whole year, and I came back to a baby sister, Nikki. I'd known about her, but had also kind of forgotten about her. Daryl was her dad, but he wasn't living with us. It was hard then to remember people you never saw in real life. She'd been born 2 days before my birthday, and I had no memories of my mother even being pregnant. When my mother brought her home from the hospital, I was still in Missouri. My brother loved her so much, he couldn't stop talking to me about her. I thought she was beautiful, prettier than I was or had ever been, which my grandmother confirmed. My mom hugged me with one arm when I came through the door behind my grandmother. My brother hugged me so hard we fell to the floor. "Show her the playground," my mother told him. There were two slides, two swing sets, and a massive sandbox less than 100 yards from our front door. We ran to the swings first. When we swung as high as we could, we let go of the straps midair and landed in the pit of soft sand. We smiled at each other, big, real smiles, and I forgot anything and anyone else. I followed him to the top of the slide, unable to control the width of my grin, even as my face began to sting and my belly rolled with excitement. "Watch out for that," he pointed to the corner of the platform we stood on. I leaned down until I could see the object, then reared back once I did. A large earthworm wriggled there in two separate parts. Someone had cut it in half. My brother poked his head over my shoulder and said, "It's gonna die." We turned away and slid to the bottom, one after the other. It didn't take long for me to integrate into life in the new apartment. My baby sister was funny. My brother had a Nintendo with two controllers, and my mom decorated my room with a white bed, a white desk, with a matching attached bookshelf, and a long white dresser. There were drawings of black children with balloons and ice cream hanging on the walls in white frames. In the mornings, we all hustled out of the house together, and at night, we usually all slept in the same room. My sister would sleep in the bed with my mother, and my brother and I would make pallets and sleep on the floor beside them. The television stayed on through the night, and I laid awake late enough to watch Perfect Strangers, Head of the Class, and The Golden Girls. Life here didn't feel anything like Missouri, but it felt good to be with family, even when I was the last one to fall asleep. Starting at a new school didn't worry me. I had been what my teacher and grandmother called a good reader in Missouri, And since my mother signed my brother and me up for a Book of the Month program, I'd been reading everything I could get my hands on for months. When we ran out of new books in our house, or I got bored rereading the ones we had, I walked across the street to Aunt Trina and Uncle Scott's apartment and read their kids' books. In fact, my aunt caught me reading to my cousins more than once. I overheard her tell my mom, "She does all the voices and everything. She's so good." I hadn't brought much from the farm, but reminded my grandmother more than once to pack all of my Little Critter, Berenstain Bears, and Frog and the Toad books. Then I made her show me that they were packed before we left. She sparked my lifelong love affair with stories, and once I lived with my mother again, my grandmother encouraged her to let my brother and me spend time at our local library. The library felt too good to be true. All those books on all those shelves, and I could just pluck them out one by one, find an empty chair, and read and read and read. When I realized nobody would stop me from browsing in the teen and adult sections, that books were a place where my age didn't matter as long as I could read the words in front of me, I found a home for my mind and spirit to take root. My imagination had already taken me on a million wild rides, but here was unlimited adventure. For the rest of my life, I would seek out the library the way some search for the soft light of a chapel in the dark. When we'd been in Missouri, my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Adams, had told my grandmother I was special. She said this about all the kids in our class. I know this because she said it directly to us, all the time. While handing our little drawings and practice sheets back, she'd stop, look each of us in the eye, and say, "Good job, honey. You're so special." I hadn't actually thought I was special, and still suspected I very much was not, but if she wanted me to be special, I would try. At home, with my grandmother, I read books and watched TV, and I played with everything. At school, I tried to figure out how to do or be something special. We'd come back to Indiana 2 weeks before my first school year was complete, so they mailed my grades. One day, my grandmother came over to the apartment and handed my mother my last report card. It said I'd passed kindergarten. The next day, we got a rare call from my dad. When my mother handed me the phone, I yelled into the receiver, "I passed kindergarten, Daddy! I passed!" "I'm so proud of you, baby girl." I could hear his smile, his pride, and I soaked it up. I've got me a smart child. I liked my first grade teacher, Mrs. York, and she seemed to like me well enough, even though I struggled to keep quiet when I was supposed to. I had a lot of questions and even more follow-up questions. Still, I sensed she was more amused by me than annoyed, and so I was not afraid of her. It helped that, in general, her decisions made sense. I appreciated the clarity of rules and routine found in her classroom. When she corrected me, she did so with obvious care, and that counted for a lot with me. Kids can always tell the difference between adults who want to empower them and adults who want to overpower them. She was the former. There hadn't been any clue Mrs. York was unhappy with me. At least, I hadn't noticed one in enough time. Sometime between the moment I left the school and the moment I arrived at my mother's front door, Mrs. York had called her. I didn't know this when I opened the door, and my mother's fists came down on my shoulders, knocking the loose straps of my backpack to the floor. I panicked. I ran into the sitting room next to the kitchen, grabbed a cushion from the wooden couch, and attempted to shield myself from the current incoming attack. What did I do? My mind scanned for something, anything I might have done and forgotten about. Did I hide something? Take something? Break something? I was coming up blank, but it was hard to hang on to a thought while my mother thrashed above me. She stopped hitting me long enough to yell at me that my teacher had called. Apparently, Mrs. York told my mother I'd been caught saying an inappropriately sexual thing to another student. You said something about a man having his hands down somebody's pants. Where did you see that? Where did you hear that from? My head continued to spin, confused, trying to remember saying something like that to anybody. No, I didn't, I said, realizing I was telling the truth. I didn't say that. Mrs. York is lying. Of course, she must have been lying, but I couldn't understand why. My mother sneered at me. That woman doesn't have any reason to lie about you. You did it. I know you did it. But I hadn't. All through me, I knew it was true that I hadn't said those words to anybody. My mother told me I had to call my best friend, the other student she'd been told I was speaking to, and apologize for my behavior. Don't you ever let me find out you've been saying sick shit to people at school. If you get kicked out, you can't stay here. I climbed the stairs to my mother's bedroom and used her phone to call my friend. What did you say to me? She asked. Why are you in trouble? I knew my mother was listening on the second phone downstairs, and I wasn't sure how much I could say, so I just repeated myself, still sobbing. I'm sorry for the thing I said to you at school today. I won't ever do it again. I could tell she was still confused when she told me it was okay, that she didn't even remember what I'd apparently said. I heard the click as my mother hung up. I told my friend I'd see her tomorrow and hung up my phone as well. I walked to my bedroom, sat on the bed, and watched the door. She'll come in, I thought. She'll come in and she'll tell me she's sorry. I slept in my own room that night, alone, but I woke up on fire. The next day, I straightened my back as I walked into the school, down the hall, and into my classroom. I put my things away along with the rest of my classmates. My best friend tried to catch my eye, but I avoided her. I had not done what I was accused of, but all the same, I felt ashamed of the accusation. I could hear my mother's voice drawing out the word sick to describe me and what she'd been told I'd done. That word and that tone landed on and stuck to me. I was certain all you had to do was look at me to see it, so I didn't want someone I cared about to look at me. I wasn't sure I cared about Mrs. York anymore. She'd lied about me. After finishing my morning practice sheet, busy work I hated, I calmly walked back to Mrs. York's desk. I stood in front of her until she looked up from the paper she was writing on. She looked surprised to find me there, and I was angry about that. She'd called my home and lied about me. My mother had gotten so angry she hadn't spoken to me for the rest of the evening. This woman had no idea the havoc she'd let loose in my home or what it had cost me. Or, I thought, she just doesn't care. I felt my anger rise with my breath. She should have expected me. Can I help you, Ashley Ford? I looked into her eyes and asked, why did you tell my mother I said a bad thing when I didn't? The curious smile dropped from her face, replaced by a confused one. She started to speak, to explain, I think, then stopped herself. She called another student over, a girl, smaller than me, who I didn't really know yet. I'd met my best friend Jamie on the second day of school and hadn't really branched out since then. One good friend was enough for me. Others would come eventually, but as long as I had one, I felt a satisfactory sense of companionship. This girl was not my friend. Mrs. York crouched in front of her. Honey, didn't you tell me you heard Ashley Ford say something yesterday? The girl looked at her, then looked at me. Back to her. Again to me. Then she shrugged and said as if we were both wasting her time, well, it did sound like Ashley Ford. This time, Mrs. York's smile faded altogether. You didn't actually see her say it? The girl rolled her eyes. It did sound like her, though. Okay. Mrs. York raised one hand to stop the girl from speaking and put the other over her own face. Oh, dear. She looked at me and understood something unintended had occurred here, and to her credit, she tried to fix it. Ashley, I'm so sorry. I believed her apology and was certain she'd been misled, but knew that wasn't enough. You have to call my mother, I said. Please, you have to call my mother and tell her I didn't say it. She promised me she would. I reminded her again before the end of the day. You have to tell her it wasn't me, I repeated. On the bus ride home, I fantasized of arriving to an open door, my mother waiting in the frame, waiting to scoop me up into hugs and kisses and apologies. She would tell me how sorry she was, that she should have believed me, that she knew I was good, and she would promise never to hit me again. My mind wouldn't let me imagine much further than that. But that part seemed key, appropriate even, given the severity of response the night before. She would want to make it up to me, make it right. That's what you did for somebody you loved, right? At least, that's what you did in the movies. The door was closed when I walked up to it, but that wasn't the most important part of my fantasy scenario anyway. I opened the door and walked into the kitchen. My mother was cooking something on the stovetop. I tried to read her body language before approaching, but couldn't detect any specific note of danger. She looked at me, over her shoulder, still using her hands to stir whatever was in the pot. You got homework? I pulled off my backpack without taking my eyes off her. Just reading, I said. We both knew that meant I'd already finished. Did my teacher call you? She stopped stirring the pot. Yes, she did. She started stirring again. I took a step closer to her back, unsure if she had heard me or if we were talking about the same call. Did she tell you that I didn't say that thing? Did she tell you that girl lied on me? My mother stopped stirring the pot again and cut off the burner. She turned to face me. Her face was stony and set. We made eye contact and it scared me, but I didn't feel I was allowed to look away. Yes, Ashley, she told me. Now why are you still in my face? She knew what I wanted, and she wanted me to know it would not be mine. We were locked in a power struggle, not that I would have known to call it that, and I was confused because I did not want power from my mother. I wanted her to acknowledge the pain in my body and heart. I wanted it to mean something to her because she loved me, and I knew it, and I couldn't understand why she couldn't just say sorry. What was so wrong with me that I didn't deserve that? That night, I dreamed I flew across a black night, like the children in Tar Beach, to the farm in Missouri, and that when I landed, I saw I'd been cut in two parts, and somehow left one half of myself behind in Indiana. I didn't want to go back for that part. Chapter 9. When my brother and I got in trouble, which we did from time to time, and my mother decided we deserved a whooping, he would run. The minute he understood what was about to go down, his feet would start flying. He used to tell me he could tell she was angry before I did, that he saw the signs I couldn't. If you look close, he whispered to me, right before she yells, the hair on the back of her neck curls up. That's when I run. He would be up the stairs, under the bed, and tucked into a corner too far for her to reach before my mother ever saw him leave. But I would still be standing there in front of her, crying. To me, it didn't make sense to run. The time it saved in anticipation, you paid in pain. I didn't tell on myself, but I always felt caught anyway. Right before I started the second grade, my mother's work schedule changed. Her new hours didn't permit her to be home by the time my brother and I returned from school, so we stayed with a babysitter. She was a younger woman who lived in the same apartment complex. She'd been hired by a different family to watch their two boys in their apartment, so my brother and I met them there every day. I didn't like it there, and I didn't like our babysitter. When one of the boys discovered black garbage bags full of porn magazines, he snuck them in a few at a time and brought them to the rest of us playing video games in a bedroom upstairs. When the babysitter caught us going through one, she sat on the bed and looked at it with us. Everybody else looked relieved, but the pit of my stomach wrenched itself into a ball, and I only felt an increase in danger that now outweighed my curiosity about naked bodies. She made us promise not to tell our parents. Sometimes my mother would come pick us up from the apartment after work, especially if we would immediately be running an errand or visiting someone. Other times she would call for us, and the babysitter would send us down the sidewalk toward our own front door. After one such call, we gathered our backpacks and 2 minutes later walked into a house full of family. It wasn't uncommon to come home to my mother's sisters, their husbands, a few extended family members, and one or two friends of the family lounging around, talking, laughing, and smoking. My grandmother used to say, "What's the point of living by everybody if you don't want to see anybody?" I came from social people, and though I felt overwhelmed by their company, I was always glad to see them. My mother was often in a good mood when she had good company. Before anyone spoke to me, I felt a difference in this gathering. There was smoking and talking, but no laughing. The grown-ups weren't spread out around the house, but huddled in the small living room. My brother and I began to walk slowly and only on the balls of our feet, afraid of making any unintended noise. One of my aunts said, "How could she not believe her own baby?" The rest began to answer, all at the same time. "Over a man. That girl said he touched her. Couldn't be me. I would die first." That was my mother. I would die before I let anybody hurt my kids. She looked up then and saw my brother and me standing in the hallway, halfway between where she sat and the door we'd just walked through. "Upstairs," she said. "Go play." Through a combination of eavesdropping and talking with my cousins, I found out that one of us had accused her stepdad of molesting her. Her mother did not believe her, but we were on my cousin's side. It was an explanation cobbled together by the words of children and the silence of adults. My mother never told me what happened, not specifically, but our home shifted again. I was 7 years old, and it had become very important to her that I understood what sex was and what it meant if someone was trying to do it to me. Over and over, she explained to my brother and me that we had sexual parts, but they were private, not to be seen, noticed, or mentioned by anyone else until we were married. "If anybody ever tries anything with you, I will kill them." She'd stare as if we were already hiding something she would soon find out with or without our confessions. "I will believe you, and I will kill them." My brother and I both had to sit through talks on sex, but only I had to go through the interrogations. My mother became hypervigilant about how I interacted with boys and men, even my own uncles and cousins. She wanted me to see danger everywhere. My mother and grandmother would shake their heads at me and lament that I was too friendly and that men and boys would take that the wrong way. My grandmother would say, "All that smiling will get you in trouble if the wrong person thinks it's cute." I didn't want to be suspicious. I didn't want to look at my uncles, cousins, classmates, and teachers and think about what they might be thinking they want to do to me. It made me feel sick inside, like I was doing something wrong. not just bad, which could be harmless, but wrong. Wrong hurt people, and I didn't want to get hurt or hurt anyone else. My mother insisted I learn to be more skeptical, and my lapses in judgment infuriated her. When my 12-year-old cousin T brought one of his guy friends over, I didn't give either of them much of a second thought. When they started talking about buying candy from the lady who sold it in paper brown bags out of her unit across the parking lot, I perked up. I had 5 $1 bills and 3 quarters in my top dresser drawer. I gave them 2 quarters so they had enough to get a full bag. T lifted me up in the air and kissed me on the cheek. "Thank you, Ash." They both left, money in hand, sprinting down the